Instead, the United States of America, that unlawfully expanded from the original 13 rebellious New England British colonies on the Atlantic seaboard to 50 illegal states, will be replaced by the same number of sovereign independent states where the black people, the Hispanics, the non-European migrants, and of course, the Native Amerindians will enjoy their birthrights. We're not daydreaming, but irrespective of whatever happens on January 20th, or does not happen, we definitely desire the end of the satanic aspirations of the United States of America. It is time for the curtain to come down on America's international terrorism, which means any sane person in the White House should not only withdraw the U.S. terrorist forces from all parts of the world, but stop the persecution of peace-loving masses oppressed by the Zionists, the Takfiris, and the ruthless regimes of spurious states.
The coronavirus pandemic, which resulted in prolonged lockdowns and tough preventive measures, has had an adverse effect on the global economy. Like any other crisis, countries responded differently to the COVID-19 outbreak, which determined the extent of their success in tackling the ill effects of the disease. Take China, for example, the world's second largest economy. It was bound to overtake the United States as the biggest economy in 2030. But according to economists, the Asian country is expected to pass the U.S. 2 years earlier, as its gross domestic product is forecast to expand by more than 8% this year alone.
I would think that the Chinese economy would overtake the U.S. economy before then, very shortly, because the Chinese government, under the leadership of President Xi Jinping, they're proceeding with a completely different economic political orientation. They see development of infrastructure and industry as primary. And of course, they've uplifted, removed from poverty almost 800 million people, which is close to three times the size of the United States.
Moreover, China is the only major economy to have avoided contraction in 2020. This was despite an ongoing economic war between Washington and Beijing. U.S. President Donald Trump levied massive tariffs on Chinese imports to offset Beijing's trade surplus with Washington. But experts argue that the U.S. lackluster handling of the coronavirus ironically gave China the economic advantage. That begs the question, what would be the upcoming U.S. administration's response to this reality? And how is Washington going to adjust its policy toward its biggest competitor? Over the past 4 years, Donald Trump's America First policy took U.S. protectionism to a new level. Trump started trade wars with allies and foes alike, ripped up trade deals, and made attempts to play against international trade rules. In hindsight, those attempts, which were predominantly made to hinder China's economic growth, have proven counterproductive. China's success to rein in the COVID-19 pandemic helped Beijing solidify its position in the global economy. Now, many American and European firms are more likely to focus on China, considering its potential to be the only large source of growth after the pandemic ends.
And under President Trump, he had a misguided conception. In fact, it's not clear he had a clear conception of what is unique about American economic policy, such as I identified the founding of our economic principles from Alexander Hamilton through Franklin Roosevelt and even into John F. Kennedy. understood the role of infrastructure in building up our economy and the role of the state. President Trump wanted to reduce the role of the state and believed that economic wealth was measured by the stock market.
President-elect Joe Biden has vowed to put an end to U.S. isolationism.
America is back, ready to lead the world, not retreat from it. Once again, sit at the head of the table.
But achieving the leading role for the U.S. would be much harder now, considering 4 years of Trump's attempts to retreat from international norms. Also, the success of Biden's China policy, which involves creating an alliance to counter Beijing's growing clout across the world, is questionable.
It's not clear to me what President Biden's policies will be. He has surrounded himself with people from the Obama administration, primarily some from the Clinton administration. They have a pronounced anti-China bent to them. The Democrat Party is also very anti-China, as is the leadership of the Republican Party.
Trump entered the Oval Office with the promise of making America great again. What transpired in the past 4 years, however, left the country in a far different position than what the outgoing U.S. president had pledged.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has held a two-day drill in central Iran. During the massive military exercises, the IRGC targeted and destroyed the mock enemy vessels in the Indian Ocean with long-range ballistic missiles. The first stage of the large-scale military exercise, codenamed the Great Prophet 15, kicked off on Friday. IRGC units launched a barrage of surface-to-surface ballistic missiles, which were followed by operations by offensive bomber drones. The missiles, equipped with detachable warheads, are guided from outer space and are able to penetrate into the enemy's missile shield. On the second day of the drills, the IRGC's missiles detected and destroyed the targets as they were sailing 1,800 kilometers away in a remote area in the ocean. A mixed attack involving a new generation of surface-to-surface ballistic missiles and drones was carried out, and all designated targets were destroyed with pinpoint accuracy. The mocked strikes were launched with the presence of the chairman of the Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, who said that Iran does not intend to attack any country. However, he said the country's armed forces will respond with all might in the shortest time if any adversary had malicious intentions toward the Islamic Republic.
Choosing a barrage of long-range missiles against naval targets illustrates that if the enemies of the Islamic Republic have ill intentions against our national interests, maritime trade routes and territory, they will come under missile strike and will be destroyed.
Donald Trump had attempted through his sanctions to withdraw the JCPOA to weaken Iran. This has not happened, and these exercises certainly demonstrate that. He had wanted Iran in a position that any of those countries, the United States, Israel, or Saudi Arabia, could successfully invade and attack and conquer Iran. But by these exercises, military exercises that have recently been held, Iran has demonstrated that these sanctions have failed, that Iran remains a strong, powerful country dedicated to protecting its people, assisting its allies, and will certainly not surrender or give in to or be vulnerable to attack by its enemies.
The IRGC military exercises started shortly after the Iranian Navy finished its naval drills in the country's strategic southern waters. The drills are aimed at boosting the preparation and military prowess of the country's armed forces. The IRGC military exercise came after Iranian Navy's drills codenamed Ehtedar-e-Daryayi 99. The two-day drills were held in the Sea of Oman and the Persian Gulf. A week prior to that, Iran held a massive drone maneuver across half of the country. These drills were launched amid heightened tensions between Iran and the U.S. in the final days of Donald Trump's presidency. Tensions have been simmering between the two countries in the past couple of months as the U.S. increases military presence in the region.
These exercises, I think, have been very important strategically for Iran in relation to the United States, because they have demonstrated, as I mentioned earlier, that the sanctions have not worked. So it is in the United States government under Joe Biden, it's in the U.S. government's interest to respect Iran, to re-enter the JCPOA, and to deal with Iran as another global citizen, trading with it, allowing trade with other countries, and working with it in a peaceful manner. These exercises have been a show of strength.
Last month, two US B-52 bombers flew over the region. The move marked Washington's third dispatch of nuclear-capable bombers to the region in less than 2 months. The US Navy had earlier announced the arrival of a nuclear-powered submarine in the Persian Gulf. The USS Georgia passed the Strait of Hormuz accompanied by two American warships, making it the first missile-loaded submarine of its kind to enter the region in 8 years. Analysts say these moves can signal Trump's intentions for triggering a conflict with Iran in his final days in office in order to distract attention from a string of failures in the past couple months. Many others say the outgoing U.S. president is simply seeking to complicate his successor's plans in coming back to the negotiating table with Iran over the nuclear deal. They say the U.S. president could be thinking about saddling President-elect Biden with some kind of military operation which could damage his efforts to come back to the JCPOA. Iran has time and again said its missile program is strictly for defensive purposes. However, Tehran says it will respond to any hostile action with a strong attack and maximum power.
As more evidence comes to light as to just who was involved in the protests that saw five people die in the storming of the US Capitol building, it seems that many of those involved were serving or ex-military staff, raising the question as to just how right-wing the US actually leans. So serious is the situation that the Pentagon has launched a probe into extremist views from within the US military complex as the body finally comes to terms and accepts that racism is rooted deep within the American system. Since the Pentagon has now acknowledged the problem, this raises the question as to whether the activities of those serving in the military and were part of the mob that broke into the Capitol actually broke more than just one law in the process.
Well, absolutely. In fact, these military officers that have been complicit, and it's not just the military, not just the Department of Defense, but also elected officials such as Senator Hawley, and also the police officers who we have seen on video leading these so-called insurrectionists into the Capitol, supporting them, taking photos with them. These are absolutely illegal and pose a big problem for the ruling class, because these people, these institutions, are the armed wing of the ruling class. They are there to protect the bourgeoisie. They are there to protect these elected officials and their rule of law.
However, the allegations are nothing new, as the US military has long been known to have racist views, as well as openly recruiting members of far-right or white supremacist groups. A report in the Guardian newspaper 6 months ago saw that the US military had already conducted a report into racism, showing that over a third of personnel had witnessed acts of racism in the service, a figure that's risen by some 14% since Trump took office. It also became apparent that many leaders within the white supremacists and far-right groups in the US were either serving or veterans of the US military, hence clearly linking the military-like discipline within such groups to the actual military body within the United States. Yet, as mentioned, this is nothing new, as the US has long displayed such traits. But what is apparent is the alarming and dramatic rise in such incidents, likely sparked by one very obvious catalyst. As Donald Trump finds himself ever more estranged from the grand old party and the presidency of the United States, his 4 years in the White House have left a legacy that no US president would be proud of, in particular when it comes to dealing with the diversity within his own nation. The endorsement of numerous acts of racial violence, discrimination and protest has left Trump leaving the White House having divided his nation. So many of his actions have actively encouraged and incited white supremacist groups to take a stand in the name of the so-called American Constitution. Trump also failed to deal with the Black Lives Matter protests following the murder of George Floyd by white police officers in Minneapolis. Had he done this promptly, it may just have given him another 4 years in the Oval Office. Trump has, in essence, created a divided and apartheid nation, something that incoming Joe Biden will no doubt have to reunite in his first term as president. However, with Trump very much still active in the background, the task is something that Biden must tackle head-on in order to resolve. With Trump having set the conditions to thrive, the question that now remains to be asked is whether Trump's legacy will lead to a civil or race war within the United States, whether he's in office or not.
Well, the empire is in decline, but it is not anywhere near ready to collapse. We might spend decades, we might spend maybe a year, but it will be time before the empire is collapsing and there will be those factions. The only future that the United States has is either a socialist one or a fascist one. And this battle will have to come eventually, but we're not anywhere near it yet. But the divisions are very deep.
Today I am calling on all Americans to...
Donald Trump has undoubtedly been the most controversial president of the United States. He has managed to make sworn enemies and inspire diehard supporters all across a divided America. His term in office is almost over now, but not the mixed feelings and fierce controversy surrounding the outgoing U.S. president. This week, Trump set a new record. He became the first ever American commander-in-chief to be impeached for a second time by the House of Representatives. Trump now faces trial in the Senate for allegedly inciting a group of his extremist supporters to violently attack Congress last week. In the worst possible scenario, he could be barred from ever holding public office again. That would practically mean the end of his political career. Back in 2019, Trump was impeached over his dealings with Ukraine, but finally acquitted by the Senate. This time, things could look a lot different, as a growing number of his fellow Republicans have said openly that the embattled president must be convicted. Trump has never been so isolated. Many members of his inner circle have either abandoned the lame duck president or seem to have distanced themselves from him. The outgoing president has also lost his cherished Twitter account, and many large corporations are boycotting him. Trump could be wiped off the face of U.S. politics, but his legacy will live on as dangerous divisions deepen in American society.
His main legacy for America is that he's the only president in the history, in American history, to have been impeached twice. Through his mismanagement and his ignorance, he allowed the COVID-19 pandemic to ravage this country, to decimate the economy, and he's the worst president in American history.
400,000 small.
This is expected to complicate things for Joe Biden from day one in office.
That we're in the middle of the once in several generations economic crisis.
The United States will soon have a new president. Joe Biden will take office in the coming days. His upcoming swearing-in ceremony will, however, be different from any past presidential inauguration, all thanks to Trump. Security concerns intensified over the past week. Federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies are taking extraordinary measures to secure the ceremony in the capital of the nation. Authorities say they have received information indicating the possibility of more violence during the inauguration. The FBI, for instance, says armed protests are being planned all across America. More than 20,000 National Guard troops will be among the forces that will try to secure President-elect Joe Biden's swearing-in ceremony. Security forces say they want to prevent a repeat of last week's deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The developments of the past weeks in the U.S. have raised serious questions about the credibility of American democracy. Was Biden democratically elected? Authorities have found no evidence of irregularities. So why does Trump still insist that the November election was stolen? And why do so many millions of Americans still believe what he says? Some observers believe the post-election chaos in the United States shows a growing lack of trust in the system and elections.
That's evidence that the experiment called democracy right now isn't working. We expect there to be a orderly transition of government is a good thing. but what we have to go through to ensure that there is an orderly transition of government does not bode well for America.
Biden will probably try to improve the situation, but the divisions in the United States are too deep and cannot be mended overnight.
So tonight, I'd like to talk to you about our way forward.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
World Health Organization has criticized wealthy countries and pharmaceutical companies for pursuing their own coronavirus vaccine arrangements, even though such a nationalistic and competitive approach to inoculation threatens to magnify deadly global inequalities while prolonging the COVID-19 pandemic and associated economic crisis. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Kenny Stencil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Warning World is on Brink of a Catastrophic Moral Failure. WHO Chief Denounces Vaccine Hoarding by Rich Nations. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. I need to be blunt, the world is on the brink of a catastrophic moral failure, and the price of this failure will be paid with lives and livelihoods in the world's poorest countries. That ominous warning comes from the head of the World Health Organization, who on Monday, January 17th, criticized the wealthy countries and pharmaceutical companies for pursuing their own coronavirus vaccine arrangements, even though such a nationalistic and competitive approach on inoculation threatens to magnify deadly global inequalities while prolonging the COVID-19 pandemic and associated economic crisis. Even as they speak the language of equitable access, some countries and companies continue to prioritize bilateral deals, going around COVAX, driving up prices, and attempting to jump to the front of the queue, said WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom, speaking from the United Nations headquarters in Geneva at the start of the WHO Executive Board's week-long virtual meeting. This is wrong. The WHO-backed COVAX program is an international and cooperative project aimed at ensuring that the inhabitants of poor countries receive vaccines. Tedros explained that while the UN Health Agency has secured 2 billion doses from 5 producers, with options on more than 1 billion additional doses, its effort to achieve a just distribution of doses could be undermined by vaccine nationalism and the pharmaceutical industry's attempt to maximize profits. The leaders of poor countries are growing increasingly unsure about whether COVAX will get the vaccines it needs and whether high-income countries will keep the promises they have made, said Tedros, adding that the promise of equitable access is at serious risk. Most manufacturers have prioritized regulatory approval in rich countries where the profits are highest, rather than submitting full dossiers to WHO, Tedros continued. The WHO chief explained that inadequate information sharing by drug makers has impeded the agency's ability to greenlight more shots for emergency use, and called on vaccine producers to accelerate the approval process by providing full data for regulatory review in real time. Tedros noted that just 25 doses have been given in one lowest-income country, not 25 million, not 25,000, just 25. The WHO chief contrasted that figure with the 39 million doses that had been allocated in 49 higher-income countries. Alluding to the mistakes of the HIV and H1N1 pandemics, previous manifestations of global health inequality, Tedros called the COVID-19 response an opportunity to beat history, to write a different story. 40 years ago, a new virus emerged and sparked a pandemic. Life-saving medicines were developed, but more than a decade passed before the world's poor got access to them. 12 years ago, a new virus emerged and sparked a pandemic. Life-saving vaccines were developed, but by the time the world's poor got access, the pandemic was over. 1 year ago, a new virus emerged and sparked a pandemic. Life-saving vaccines have been developed. What happens next is up to us. Rich countries and pharmaceutical corporations teamed up to create 44 bilateral deals in 2020. And an additional 12 agreements have been signed so far this year, said Tedros. These side deals could postpone vaccine deliveries to poor countries and create exactly the scenario COVAX was designed to avoid, with hoarding, a chaotic market, an uncoordinated response, and continued social and economic disruption. It's right that all governments want to prioritize vaccinating their own health workers and older people first, Tedros continued. But it's not right that younger, healthier adults in rich countries are vaccinated before health workers and older people in poorer countries. calling the rapid development of safe and effective coronavirus vaccines a stunning scientific achievement and much-needed source of hope, Tedros said that vaccines are the shots in the arm we all need, literally and figuratively. But we now face the real danger, he continued, that even as vaccines bring hope to some, they become another brick in the wall of inequality between the world's haves and have-nots, especially given how the recent emergence of new coronavirus variants has intensified the demand for doses. Not only does this me-first approach leave the world poorest and most vulnerable people at risk, it's also self-defeating, said Tedros. Ultimately, these actions will only prolong the pandemic, the restrictions needed to contain it, and human and economic suffering. Echoing critiques of vaccine apartheid and demands for a people's vaccine, the WHO chief called on all countries to work together in solidarity to ensure that within the first 100 days of this year, vaccination of health workers and older people is underway in all countries. And Tedros urged pharmaceutical companies to devote a larger share of their product to the COVAX supply rather than prioritizing bilateral deals, and asked countries with bilateral contracts to share their own doses with COVAX, especially once they have vaccinated their own health workers and older populations. There will be enough vaccine for everyone, Tedros noted. But right now, we must work together as one global family to prioritize those most at risk of severe diseases and death in all countries.
European News Bulletin.
Hello, everyone. From the British capital, my name is Mina Taylor, and we begin this edition of the program with our top story. A global coalition of Muslim organizations have submitted a formal complaint to the United Nations Human Rights Council demanding immediate legal action against France over the violation of its Muslim citizens' rights. The complaint represents the first coordinated civil society pushback against Emmanuel Macron's anti-Islam policies, which activists claim they've acted in clear violation of French Muslims' basic rights. Robert Carter fills us in.
Amid deepening concerns over state-backed French Islamophobia, a global coalition of Muslim NGOs has teamed up to take on the government. 36 Muslim organizations from 13 countries have submitted a joint complaint to the UN Human Rights Council, urging them to take action against France's increasingly hostile policies. The UK-based Muslim Public Affairs Committee was one of the groups that signed the complaint.
What Macron is doing is weaponizing secularism, let us say, French secularism in particular, for his Islamophobic agenda. And he's justifying this by stating that French Muslims are essentially causing separatism, when in reality he's framing this, all the policies all are very... the epitome of trying to frame it as a Muslim problem in a very similar way that Hitler did with the Jews, and tried to frame all the ills of what's happening in Germany as a Jewish problem.
Tensions between the French President Emmanuel Macron and the Muslim world has been at an all-time high since last year, when Macron introduced new legislation targeting so-called Islamic extremism and defending deeply offensive caricatures insulting Islam's holy prophet. The caricatures led to furious worldwide protests, while the anti-Islamism laws paved way for a local crackdown, which saw 76 mosques forced to close, the country's biggest Muslim charity and an anti-Islamophobia organization banned, dozens arrested, and hundreds of planned deportations. In October, the founder of Baraka City, Idris C. Hamedi, experienced firsthand France's new approach. After his home was violently raided by riot police, after he condemned Islamophobic government ministers and an anti-Islam activist on Twitter.
For example, they sent me a message, strong message, with the special forces. They closed my organization. They closed the CCIF. They closed the mosque. They closed a lot of organizations. So the Muslims around Baraka City and another organization like that, they will be afraid. It's very complicated to explain you, to share you the feeling of the Muslim community. But with beard or without beard, you have problem. With hijab or without hijab, you have a problem. Now the target, the mind of the Muslim community.
The passionate street protests may have stopped for now, but the Muslim response to Macron's anti-Islam policies hasn't finished yet. With an additional complaint due to be sent to the European Union later this year, with the hopes of forcing Macron into a U-turn on these policies. Robert Carter, London.
And Robert Carter is with us for more. Rob, Macron claims all he's trying to do is protect France from, quote, radical extremism and terrorism. So why does it feel like this is a concerted effort to crush spirits and minds and an entire religion?
Well, I think that the only person that can be blamed for that is the French president himself. If you actually follow his comments and interviews on the subject, his language can only be described as extremist in its nature. He has conflated the religion of Islam and essentially all Muslims with the actions of extremists and takfiris, which are, of course, a minority criminal element. But what he's done is he's done what typical Islamophobes in the West tend to do, is when one criminal commits a crime, even a horrific crime such as murder, he then conflates and blames the religion of Islam as being part of the problem. Not French imperialist foreign policy in the Middle East. No, not at all. No mention of that. It's only focused on the religion. And why does he do that? Because there are political benefits to scapegoating the Muslim minority in France. Obviously, Islamophobia in France is on the rise. There is a right-wing populist vote, which he's hoping to profit from. And he's done very well, in fact, in kind of reviving his political legacy by attacking Islam and trying to portray himself as some kind of Napoleon fighting off a foreign invader or something like this. But his language is very dangerous.
But what would be mentioned here is that France is essentially a non-Muslim country. So shouldn't Muslims accept a degree of secularism in their lives?
Well, according to the French constitution, it is a secular republic. However, the definition of secularism in French society is that religion stays out of the political sphere, but also the political sphere stays out of the lives of religious people's beliefs and daily religious habits. And this is something which Macron has actually breached first. He's trying to police the thought of Muslims. He doesn't want them to believe any kind of political identity, which is contrary to French state policy. And this is, of course, a breach of people's human rights. He's also breaching people's privacy by spying on them, essentially. Anyone who's been flagged up at schools, including children, can be have their homes raided. And he's also breaching people's rights to religious practice by closing down mosques, closing down the biggest charity, closing down the biggest anti-Islamophobia organization in the country as well. So this just reeks of authoritarianism, of totalitarianism, and the fact that it's targeting a minority, a religious minority only in the legislation, raises a lot of fears that this could escalate, and it's based on racism and scapegoating, Amina.
And very briefly, Rob, how successful might this global complaint letter be to the UN?
We have yet to see how the UN will respond to this. I think that the UN will actually potentially intervene and at least offer some kind of commentary, which could be quite damning to France's government's handling Also, we hope that the organization has more action planned. They wouldn't go into details when I spoke to MPAC UK, but they did say there was more plan. There was a plan being put in place. So the fact that there is more pressure being applied to the French government, and we haven't just essentially let it die away with the headlines, move on and ignore the problem, this is a positive sign, and it's important that Muslims across the globe continue the pressure.
All right. Wonderful. Good to have you, as always, Robert Carter. Now, already souring relations between the United Kingdom and China are set to deteriorate even further, because at the end of this month, from the 31st of January, Hong Kong nationals will be able to apply for an exclusive UK visa that could pave the way to British citizenship for them and their families. Hundreds of thousands are expected to take the Brits up on their offer, at least in the first 5 years. But both China and Hong Kong say this is a breach of the Sino-British joint agreement. Bianca Rahimi fills us in.
In July 2020, following the enforcement of new national security laws on Hong Kong by China, the UK announced plans to expand visa rights to Hong Kong residents who claimed British National Overseas or BNO status before Britain handed over its former colony in 1997. Until recently, BNO passports did not give Hong Kong citizens the right of residence in the UK, but Number 10 has now changed the rules.
We made clear, Mr. Speaker, that if China continued down this path, we would reintroduce a new route for those with British national overseas status to enter the UK, granting them limited leave to remain, with the ability to live and work in the UK and thereafter to apply for citizenship. And that is precisely what we will do now.
China and Hong Kong both say this violates the Sino-British Declaration that paves the way for Hong Kong to return to Chinese rule. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam says the BNO is a form of travel document, not a form of nationality.
If one side, and that is the UK government, tries to deviate from that mutual understanding and bilateral agreement, then of course it's legitimate for the other side, that is the Central People's Government, to consider any countermeasures. And the Hong Kong SAR government will of course support any countermeasures to be adopted by the Central People's Government.
UK-China relations deteriorated in 2020. The UK banned Chinese telecom giant Huawei from the build-out of the UK's 5G network. It put forward a proposal to screen and block certain mergers and acquisitions from Chinese investors on national security grounds, and as a former colonial power decided to throw its weight around, declaring China's national security laws on Hong Kong to be a breach of the Sino-British Joint Declaration. On this pretext, Number 10 is offering almost three-quarters of Hong Kong's population a fast-track route to British citizenship, stoking fears of brain drain in the city, especially in its healthcare system. England alone has around 50,000 vacancies for registered nurses, and the COVID-19 pandemic has thrown the NHS's staffing crisis into stark relief. Brexit has made sourcing health professionals from Europe much more difficult, and strict immigration policies also make recruitment from abroad very challenging. Bianca Rahimi, London.
In some developing news, lawyers for Jeremy Corbyn have accused Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer of making inflammatory and disingenuous attacks on his predecessor at a High Court hearing over Corbyn's suspension from the Labour Party following a row over anti-Semitism. Corbyn was initially suspended when he said the scale of anti-Semitism within the party had been dramatically overstated, this in the wake of a report by the Equalities Watchdog. His lawyers have requested documents that would reveal a deal with Starmer's office to readmit him to the party at all levels, and that an outright suspension went against an agreement between the two sides.
The disclosure will enable my client to plead that there was procedural unfairness and breach of duty to act in good faith.
The presiding judge, Lisa Sullivan, said she would give her ruling on Corbyn's application as soon as possible. Well, Jackie Walker, the former Labour member who's been following very closely the developments on this story, joins us. And Ms. Walker, even if Jeremy Corbyn is reinstated fully, it seems this whole scenario has gone beyond a simple case of reconciliation. What are your thoughts?
I think it's very hard
to see what function there would be for Jeremy now in the Labour Party, because I'm pretty sure that there would be further steps, as we saw happen with Ken Livingstone and Chris Williamson, to exclude him as much as they possibly could.
Now, there seems to be a lot of pressure to make an example of Corbyn, and you mentioned some other names here where it's been clear to even the equalities watchdog here that it's gone above and beyond.
Absolutely. This is not just about excluding people. This is about shaming them and making them pariahs, because what the Labour establishment and what I call the parliamentary elite cannot bear is the thought of having anybody in power who might want to actually change the status quo and their status quo.
Now, it seems that the Labour Party is signalling a different direction here. We heard today about the leak that a former Israeli spy is part of Starmer's close team. Is there a place for supporters like yourself and Corbyn within this new Labour?
I have no idea about people like me. I can tell you about me, but I'm not going to talk about people like me. I would say what's clear about Starmer's Labour is that if you want change, if you want to be supporting the poor, if you want equality for all people, the Labour Party is not going to be the place to deliver it. That kind of change is going to come from organisations outside of the Labour Party and from actions on the streets.
So what are the optics on this leak report about the new members of Starmer's team?
It's extraordinary, isn't it, that we have somebody who came from a special intelligence unit of the Israeli army, and he has been appointed to be involved at such a high level with Labour's social media. I mean, just imagine if that was somebody who was found to have been involved in Russia or in China, and we can see how this is playing out in terms of the way that the Labour Party is going. I mean, it's becoming, I think, a fully fledged, officially pro-Israel party.
Well, sobering words there, Jackie Walker, as always, thank you. And we move now to a roundup of the European situation in regards to COVID, because the new variant of the virus, first detected in Britain, is now starting to gain a foothold in Belgium. The country has been particularly hard hit by the pandemic, reporting just over 20,400 confirmed deaths and over 680,000 confirmed cases. Elsewhere, the Spanish Health Ministry has reported over 84,000, its highest number of coronavirus cases across a single weekend since the beginning of the pandemic's peak in 2020. Now, the cumulative total so far in the country has been 2.3 million cases, with just shy of 54,000 deaths. Across the border, Portugal's Prime Minister António Costa has announced that stricter lockdown rules will be imposed on the country as surging COVID rates push hospitals to the limits of their capacity. The country has over 557,000 COVID cases, with over 9,000 deaths. France, which has seen its total death toll go past 70,000 over the past weekend, it's begun a campaign to start vaccinating those over 75. The country has over 2.91 million cases.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Now, heavily armed pro-Trump supporters have been gathering near government buildings across the U.S. just a day before the inauguration ceremony of President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris.
Safety in America? No problem with this. This is what keeps Americans safe.
The militarized protests come just a day after former FBI Director James Comey warned of a serious risk of violence at Wednesday's swearing-in ceremony. On Monday, the U.S. Capitol complex was temporarily put in lockdown during rehearsals for the inauguration after a fire in a homeless encampment caused security concerns. Robert, in Lakesh, well, Trump is on his way out, we think, but not before some rather sobering headlines, especially if you're having a look about the country's immigration policy here. Very stark, very dark news.
Absolutely. This is a very worrying story, especially if policies do not change under the incoming Biden administration. What we have here to report on today is that under Trump, ICE are about to deport a financial consultant named Paul Pierilis, who has never been to the country of Haiti. However, he's being deported there. And this goes along with back in October, there was a massive push by the Trump administration to deport Haitians in that month, but this man has never actually been there in the entirety of his life. And this also goes along with calls to completely reform and even abolish ICE as well for the roles they've played in some of the inhuman treatment called by many human rights groups like Amnesty International of refugees coming to the border of the United States. We know that the Biden administration has promised on its first day that there will be immigration policy changes, but we don't yet know exactly what they're going to be. And if we're going to go on what Biden aides have been telling the 8,000 plus refugees who that came from Honduras who are heading towards the United States as we speak, then it's not a good sign going forward. And this, whilst Trump, instead of trying to focus on issues like this and do something good at the end of his term, in fact, he's poised himself now to pardon others, perhaps more war criminals, maybe even himself. And that's his last priority, it seems.
And Rob, I guess one of the issues here, people might be, well, they might be wholly, wholly disappointed because the idea of the United States abolishing its immigration service, that particular arm of it in any case, they might rename it, it might be rebranded, but demolished, abolished?
That's what some people are calling for. Some people are saying that it's lost its credibility and that other law enforcement can do its job. That's an argument that's being made. And I think it's a reaction to the fact that in these ICE facilities, people, specifically children, have been treated so badly. And it's sort of a natural reaction you could expect, especially from progressives during the ongoing movements against racial injustice in the United States, namely Black Lives Matter, that this sort of a push would be made. We've seen Congresswoman AOC come out and back these support, back this campaign as well, to at least reform ICE due to its role that it's played on the ongoing oppression of
people
there.
And is that reflected in the social media coverage of this particular story?
The first tweet we've got here is from a user called Barry. He says, "At ICE government, hollow sentiments over MLK when you are deporting Paul Pierilis to Haiti, a country he has never been a citizen of, knows little to nothing of its culture and has no connections to, perhaps because he is black. Just another example of the blatant racism which drives ICE." We've got another one here as well from Dr. Israel Romero, who says, "Child of mother, father, American citizens is not deportation, a deportation subject. Paul Pierilis, 40-year-old financial consultant, was born in French St. Martin, came to the United States when he was 5, never was in Haiti. ICE is deporting him as a Haitian. Two errors, he is not deportable as per INA law and is American."
Well, clearly that hasn't stopped the process. We'll continue to watch this. But we move on to another worrying development, and some might say hollow words from the United Kingdom.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of criticism of the United Kingdom for not standing up in a stronger way against the Israelis. And it's just, you know, words that are leveled against Israel. There's no threat of sanctions or any real punishment. And of course, when it comes to the Labour Party in this country, which under Jeremy Corbyn, of course, many are claiming anyway, would have came out against this move of around 800 settler units to be expanded inside of the West Bank illegally, a move that which has been condemned just recently today by the United Nations as well. They state it's completely illegal. However, the Labour Party has been all but silent on this issue and has not said anything, which is really surprising. The party, which is supposed to be on the left, is having next to no criticism of the most racist country on earth, many would argue, which is really a shame to many. And this is why many people have quit the Labour Party, because of their views on Palestine now and their lack of ability to try and hold Israel accountable for their illegal actions.
Well, I guess if the past is anything to go by, it's going to be a while before that scenario changes for fear of being branded anti-Semitic, no less. What's the social media reaction on this one?
The first one we have here states that if the United Kingdom was seriously concerned about Israel's illegal settlements and its decades of Palestinian land grabs, it would have done something constructive long ago. Who are you kidding? And then at loads of members of the government here, and another one as well commenting, who says this demonstrates how racist and anti-Palestinian Keir Starmer's Labour Party is. Labour remains silent whilst the Tory government expresses serious concerns over Israel's decision to build 780 settlements in the Palestinian West Bank.
Well, perhaps they saw this as Netanyahu really trying to run down the clock with Trump just hours from leaving the White House. Robert Inukesh, we'll leave it there. And we will leave you here for the time being. Keep it there, keep it locked. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Nearly a third of people who were discharged from hospitals in England after being treated for COVID-19 were readmitted to hospitals within 5 months, and almost one in eight died, according to a new study. The research, which is still to be peer-reviewed, also found a higher risk of problems developing in a range of organs after hospital discharge in those younger than 70 and ethnic minority individuals. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Natalie Grover. The piece is titled, Almost 30% of COVID patients in England readmitted to hospital after discharge, according to new study. Stay with us for more of Natalie Grover's article. Nearly a third of people who were discharged from hospitals in England after being treated for COVID-19 were readmitted to hospital within 5 months.